First for Federal News Now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
It's really been fun watching all the politics this week there at Apple. They got rid of Scott Forstall. He's the guy who was the he was the operating system guy. He came out with the OS 6, the operating system 6. He was also with the operating system for the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
He came to Apple from Next Computer, and he's been working with Steve Jobs very closely as they released the software. But he was a total and complete jerk, and everybody hated him. In fact, he was such a jerk, they called him the Mini Steve.
Whoa.
And what they did is that the new Apple CEO actually does not like all this dissension. He likes more of a collaborative environment. So he got rid of him, and he put Johnny Ives in charge of the look and feel of the software interface. Johnny Ives, of course, is a guy that's been designing the hardware, and he designed the look of the iPod, and he's got this eye for design, and he's almost the he and Steve Jobs were extremely close as they were trying to define the simplicity of the Apple products. And now they want to have that same simplicity apply to the operating system. So Johnny Ives will be put in charge of both elements of it. It's an interesting development. And so I think that's probably good for Apple. And then we're seeing Steve Sinofsky at Microsoft. He was, of course, the manager for Windows 8. And people are saying he'll probably be the next Microsoft CEO because he's been driving the software there and Microsoft really had a dry spell in software development. Like, Windows Vista was a dud. They had a series of duds.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put Steve Sinofsky in charge of software. He's the one that came out with Windows 7, which was quite a success, and then Windows 8. And he got rid of all the middle management and all the little fiefdoms there, and he got a very streamlined method of code development, and they like that approach at Apple. And so Steve Ballmer has been having everybody emulate Steve Sinofsky and how he's developed the software. So it's just kind of fun to watch all of that as we go, because there's actually a passing of the torch. In Apple, the torch was passed from Steve Jobs to the next generation, and we're seeing a passing of the torch from Bill Gates to the next generation. And so it's interesting to see how that passing of the torch work and whether the company's long term will be able to survive. And of course, we had many interesting things this week. I got particularly interested in the state of computer science education in the U.S., in fact, worldwide, and ran across this device. It was released just at the end of last year, Raspberry Pi. Raspberry Pi, and it's a credit card device. It's actually the size of a computer that's the size of a credit card, and it sells for $35. And it's really a hacker's dream. And I'll talk about the guy who was the inspiration behind Raspberry Pi. That would be PI. And it was really quite a story. And I think this is going to make a real difference in the whole state of computer science going forward in computer science education. And Philips has released October 30th a new LED light that you can control through Wi-Fi. So every light bulb is individually controlled. You pick the intensity and the color. It has three, and I'll explain the standards behind that. And I think it's going to change home lighting. It's pretty dramatically. And how that's been working on that, and what's how to buy it, how to control it. It's a very interesting topic. And we will be talking about the person behind Raspberry Pi. This would be Eben Upton later in the show. But it was, again, another extremely heavy mailbag. It's a huge mailbag.
And the forklift now comes in.
Forklift, come in. Let's go. Drop that on the table. There we go.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yeah. We got an email from Arnie. He's one of our regular listeners, Arnie McKechnie in Davidsonville, Maryland. Hi, Dr. Schertz. Last Saturday, you mentioned the use of LastPass as a way of keeping passwords straight, and you recommended it was good. It was a good CNET recommendation, etc. In the previous programs, you said you didn't like to have passwords on the cloud and recommended KeepPass, which keeps passwords on your computer. I have KeepPass and admit it isn't the easiest to use, but then again, I'm not a geek. So why the change in your saying it's okay for passwords on the cloud? I suspect it's due to some exotic encryption, but still, the cloud is not as good as on your own computer, is it? Love Tech Talk, Arnie McKechnie. Well, Arnie, thanks for being a loyal listener and catching all of my variations as my thinking evolves. Well, I do like LastPass because of its robust security features and its ease of use. This turns out to be a real issue, ease of use. If something is easy to use, then people actually use it properly. So when you create LastPass account and with a master password that's used to access your list, LastPass will ask to import your passwords into the cloud, and they encrypt your passwords with AES 256. That's a pretty robust encryption algorithm. Advanced encryption system, AES 256, 256 byte key. And so this is actually a pretty good encryption. It's held in the cloud. And the nice thing is that with this thing, if you want to interact with your passwords, you can actually do it through an on-screen keyboard, so that keyboard loggers aren't picked up. In case you're, like using it at a kiosk, they can't pick up your passwords with a keyboard logger. And it allows you, if you're traveling, to actually have your passwords with you and not have them stored on the local machine. Now, there's another thing. That's the free version, and it's extremely easy to use and get the passwords saved, and you can keep them out of your own local cache completely. But if you're really into security, dramatic security, it actually even supports multi-factor authentication. This is a higher level of security, which means you need a USB key in conjunction with your password to gain access to your password vault. So that assures you that some hacker's not going to be able to hack into the system. So it was a combination, really, of the convenience of it, which meant it would be used frequently, even if you're on multiple machines, and the robust security on the cloud. I think, though, if you're only using one computer and you don't move from computer to computer, there's probably no advantage to the cloud. You might as well just stay with my last recommendation, KeepPass. But I was thinking in terms of how I operate, operating with so many computers, how can I keep track of it in multiple computers? But so I actually reluctantly, I would say, recommended the cloud, but I checked out, and this has been reviewed by four or five of the people that I really, really recommend on the internet. So I decided that I'd give it a try, and I do like it. We got an email from Hawk in Bowie. She writes to us frequently. She's got another problem. Dear Dr.
Schertz, she's got a tough life going on over there.
It's a tough life with computers and Hawk, yeah. But she's trying to muddle through as best she can. Dear Dr. Schertz, ever since I returned from a trip to Vietnam, the calendar app on my iPhone has been messed up. It seems like my iPhone is still on Vietnam time. When I select the day at the bottom of the app, it comes up with a time and date, 11 hours advanced from my local time. Oh, that would be Vietnam time,
sure.
11 hours ahead. So when I enter an appointment, the time gets shifted 11 hours in advance after I enter it. For example, I enter an appointment in 3 p.m. on Tuesday, and I press done. It shows up at 2 a.m. on Wednesday.
Oops.
It's really hard for me to set appointments with my friends with this.
Sure.
Help. Thanks, Hawk in Bowie. Well, that's a great question, Hawk. Actually, what it is your iPhone is, in fact, still on Vietnam time. Now, what happens is that you want to click on Settings. That's the icon there. And then under Settings, there's a tab called General. Click on General. Then you scroll down to what's called the Date and Time. And then you turn, then you set the date and time so it's automatically set to the time zone. So you set time zone setting automatic, and you put that on, and then it should immediately reset to the New York time zone. Now, here's the problem, is that if you travel to Vietnam and you don't have, say, a SIM card in it, then it won't automatically change to Vietnam time because it does that through the SIM card. So if you, when you're in Vietnam, if you want to use the your the time on your iPhone without a SIM card, you have to manually go in and set it to Vietnam time, and that turns off the automatic time zone feature. So I suspect that you didn't have a SIM card there in Vietnam, and you and somebody manually set your phone to Vietnam time. Then you came back, and you didn't reset it to automatic, so then it just stayed in Vietnam time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got the same problem when I'm traveling to India, and somebody sets a time for me up in the U.S., like at 10 a.m. Friday morning, and I'm in India on India time. It shows up that it's gonna that I'm going to meet them at like 8 o'clock Friday night, India time. And so if I want to set appointments back in the U.S., I have to be very aware, and I have to enter them in India time so mm-hmm. that they show up in American time correctly. It is a bit of a problem, but I do like the way that the time zones are set up on the iPhone. You just have to be mindful of it. Now, we got an email from Jim. Dear Tech Talk, I have an HP Mini computer, and the hard drive seems to be full. However, I haven't loaded many programs on it or pictures on it. Why is it using all the space? Love the show. Thanks, Jim. Well, Jim, you can use something called a disk cleanup tool in Windows. You can use the search tool right above the start window to search for disk cleanup, and it will give you several options. Now, on the first screen, on the first tab, you can select things like remove downloaded program files, remove temporary internet files, clear the recycle bin, remove the service pack backup files, remove the temporary files. Now, these are all files that aren't critical and are transient in nature, and I just recommend getting rid of those. I'd try that first and see whether that cleared up, how much space that cleared up for you. Now, if you still need more space to be cleared up, there are more options, and there's another tab at the top called More Options in Disk Cleanup, and there are two more possibilities, removing programs not used and removing all but the most recent restore points. Now, if you don't have any software programs, I would remove all but the most recent restore points. These restore points take a lot of disk storage. And every time you do an update, it forms another restore point. So you could have literally 100 restore points there, and it just eats up a lot of disk space. So if you don't really, if you're not having any software problems, so you don't think you'll have to go back to a prior restore point, I just remove all the restore points. You just keep the last two, and that should free up quite a bit of your space. And if you still need more space, you could remove programs that you never use. That's another way to operate it. And then finally, well, you said you didn't put much on it yourself, so it's probably not programs or pictures. Now, the last thing that I do after I delete all of these unused files, I do a defragmentation, because you see, when the disk begins to get full, it can't put one file at one contiguous location, so it might put part of the file at over here and then find it another space to put the rest of the file over there, so the file is fragmented. So what I like to do is, after I've deleted all these extra files, is pull together all the fragmented files so I have no fragmentation, and then the files will actually load faster. So that's called defragmentation, or defragging your hard drive. So mm-hmm. then I run a defrag, and that, if you can just defrag, and you can search for that, and the program will come right up. That's the final thing I do. And I think that ought to fix your problem with that hard drive that's filling up a little too fast. We got an email from Paula in Wisconsin, another podcast listener.
Uh-huh.
Dear Tech Talk, I purchased a desktop HP Pavilion with Windows 7. Now, I've added myself as a new administrator. But in every instance where my name appears, it's linked with the prior owner.
That's strange.
Because he's the primary administrator.
Uh-huh.
And so he's still listed on the hard drive as an administrator, and then she added an account. He added an account with her name on it, but she's not the primary administrator, so he's still on there. So there are certain tests that I can't complete without his authorization. And, of course, he's not here. How can I get control of my new computer? Thanks, Paula. Well, actually, Paula, when you buy a new machine and somebody else has mucked around with it, your best option is to reformat and install Windows from scratch. Now, I'm hoping that when you bought the machine, he gave you the disks or at least the license number for the software so that you can do that. And so if you do have the license number for the software, I would actually take and reformat the hard drive and reinstall it. And then you know what you've got. You've got complete control of your machine. There's no way to rename an administrator account. You can create new accounts as you did it. You can give them any name you want, and you can give them administrative rights, but it doesn't change previously existing accounts. And it's difficult to delete those. Windows just doesn't like you to do that. Now, if you don't want to take my advice, and frequently people don't take my advice, so it is a possibility. It is a possibility. There is a utility that you can download, and you can reset passwords.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the physical access to the machine. So what you want to do, you want to go to the internet and search for a program called Offline NT Password and Registry Editor. Offline NT Password and Registry Editor. You download that program and burn it to a CD. Now this is actually a program which is, and the CD that you will burn will actually be a bootable version of Linux that will load this program. So then as soon as you burn the CD, you reboot your machine, it will boot off the CD and come up in this NT Password and Registry Editor. And that will allow you to reset any password that has a valid local account on your Windows system. It supports all Windows from NT 3.5 to Windows 7, as well as 64-bit and also server versions like 2003 and 2008. You don't need to know the old passwords to set a new one. So then as soon as you boot the machine, you'll pick the location of the registry. You'll have to pick which partition it's in, and then when you get to the partition, you'll pick which subdirectory it is in, and then you go in and you can reset the password. So you could go into all these admin passwords. You could basically just delete the password, and then you could log in with those names with the blank password, and you could reset a password actually manually that way. And so you could actually get control then of the administrative user for your drive. And so that's actually what you would do. By the way, you can do all this in less than 10 minutes. This is why if somebody has physical access to your machine, they can get into anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your password protection is nothing. They can reset the password with this CD. They get this CD. You give them 10 minutes on your machine. They boot on the CD. They change the password, and they could lock you out of your own machine.
Good grief.
So physical security is the key to real security.
Mm-hmm.
Great question, Paula. Let me know if you follow my advice or whether you follow the lesser recommended method of resetting the password rather than reinstalling. We got an email from Marianne. Dear Tech Talk, I got an HP computer a couple of months old, and it came with the Microsoft Office Starter Kit 2010 pre-installed. I tried to access the program. It won't come up. It tells me to go to the control panel and repair it, but I have no success. I've gone to the Microsoft site with no luck. I tried again to open the file, and nothing happened. I can't afford to purchase Office. What's your recommendation? Well, Marianne, this Microsoft Office Starter Kit's just a trial version. It probably expired. It's dead.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll either have to buy Microsoft Office or find a free alternative. You could buy it. Now, if you're going to buy Microsoft Office, I would uninstall the Starter Kit completely and just reinstall the fresh version of Office directly. That you probably could download it if you didn't want to get the CDs. Now, but you said you can't afford that. So you could get the free alternatives, and there are a couple of free alternatives. There's OpenOffice and there's LibreOffice. Now I wouldn't. So what you would do is, after you've uninstalled the Microsoft Office Starter Kit, I would select one of those. OpenOffice is currently owned by Oracle. They got ownership of it when they bought Sun Microsystems. And it's the first and most widely used free alternatives to Microsoft Office. It's been around for quite a while. Now, the open source community created a fork in this open source software when Oracle took it over because they didn't like Oracle's aggressive corporate tactics. So they wanted to get open source Office that wasn't under the control of of Oracle. So they created LibreOffice. Now, LibreOffice, of course, it's really the same thing as OpenOffice. It has the same roots as OpenOffice, but now it's evolving slightly differently in a slightly different fashion. You can download OpenOffice by going to openoffice.org. I've used OpenOffice. I don't have a problem with it. I don't really mind Oracle. They actually haven't damaged it. Or you can go to LibreOffice.org and download that if you are really want to be in the purely open source mode. And I've not used LibreOffice, but it looks like it's gotten good reviews. So I think it's as good as OpenOffice. What I don't know is what the size of the support community for it. Now, if you are a college student, or if you work at a college, or if your son is a college student or your daughter's a college student, you could get a full version at the upgrade price by using academic software. So if you have an email address with a .edu on it, and you've got a student ID, you can order academic software, and you can get Microsoft Office dirt cheap that way. And it's, instead of paying this full price, you pay about 25% the full price. I know a lot of people do that. A lot of college students do that. And it's quite easy to do. You basically, it's not sold in the stores because the stores don't make any money on it. So what you have to do, you have to go to, you can search for academic software on the internet. It'll show you all the vendors that sell academic versions of software. The one that I use, because I buy academic software at Stroud University, is Journey Ed. And that would be journeyed.com, JOURNEYED.com, Journey Ed. And I order academic software. Adobe's got it. A lot of these vendors have great, great academic pricing. So if you qualify or if somebody in the family qualifies, you can certainly get that. Good question. We got an email from Craig in Oakton. Dear Tech Talk, I receive about 300 emails daily. These are spam emails. I left out one word here when I typing his letter.
We receive
about 300 spam emails daily. How can I block them? I use Yahoo as my email provider, and I'm on Windows 7. Thanks, Craig. Well, Craig, you really can't stop spam. Anybody can send you an email that they want. They can send it anytime they want. That's the way the email system works. That's not bad because if somebody knows your email address and they want to send you an email, they can communicate with you via email, and there's not a lot of hassle. So, and blocking doesn't work very well because spammers keep changing their email address. In fact, they hijack the addresses of unsuspecting people, and then they fake the email address. And frequently, you'll get spams from email addresses that appear to be your friends.
Mm-hmm.
So if you block a particular email address, it's not really going to work to block a spammer. Now, filters can help quite a bit because filters look at the content of the email, and they have certain rules where they judge whether it's spam or not. And I'm telling you, Gmail has got a fantastic spam filter. I get maybe 200-300 spams in, probably I might have 300 spam in the spam folder, maybe 300 emails. And I would say only one or two emails leak into my inbox that I would declare as spam.
Yeah.
It is extremely good. And the reason that Gmail spam filter is so good is that it's crowdsourcing. When you get an email that you think is spam, you notify Gmail, and they get thousands of these notifications. And so they use those notifications to fine-tune their filter to get better and better and better. So with that crowdsourced feedback, it turns out to be an excellent method for filtering spam. Now Yahoo also has a filter, and they use crowdsourcing, but not quite as well as a Gmail. So first of all, you said you use Yahoo Mail. I'd make certain that your Yahoo spam filter's turned on. You may not have turned it on.
Sure.
So what you do, you want to log into your Yahoo account on the web and click under the options link near your name in the upper left side of the page, and then click on Mail Options and look at the resulting menu. And then on the Mail Options page, click on General in the left-hand column. And in that section, there's something called Spam Protection, and make sure that automatically move spam to the spam folder is checked. So I'll post these directions on the Tech Talk outline either today or tomorrow, and then you can read them. And then once you make certain that spam protection is on, then you click save, and then you're set. Now, what you want to do to make the filter even better, every time you get spam in your inbox, notify Yahoo that it's spam so they can use their crowdsourcing to make the filter better and better and better. Now, you get so much spam, though, you might be engaged in some bad practices that are actually leading to spam. If you sign up for a bunch of contests all over the place, they're basically collecting your email address.
Yeah.
So what I would do is if you want to sign up for contests, get another email account, because you can create another Yahoo account. Get another Yahoo account and that you use that other account for all of these contests, so the spam goes there instead of to your main address. Now, the other thing, if you post to a lot of forums and blogs and all, and it posts your email address, spiders pick that up. So you never want to actually put your naked email address out. So what you may want to do, you might say John, and instead of the ampersand, put A-T, at, and they say Gmail, and instead of a dot, you write D-O-T, mm-hmm. com. So somebody could look at that, and they could say John, A-T, Gmail, D-O-T, com, and they could figure it out, but then the machine that's just is going to get an email address that doesn't work. So you never want to have a naked email address posted. Always disguise it in some easily done fashion. Well, those were great questions.
Excellent questions.
And I'll tell you, we love your emails. You can email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and those emails will be forwarded to you. And also, I'll be checking the Facebook page. So you go to facebook.com/techtalkonline for any comments during the show.
And I didn't need to remind you this week that you're doing that.
No, I know.
Even though you're doing it, I didn't remind you.
After only 3 years, I'm getting it down.
4 years.
Okay.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Eben Christopher Upton. You ever heard of him before?
No, but I'm about to.
You're about to hear everything you ever wanted to know about Eben Christopher Upton. He's the founder and trustee of Raspberry Pi Foundation. That would be PI.
PI.
Yeah. Raspberry Pi Foundation. And the creator of the low-cost, credit card-size hacking computer designed to inspire the next generation of programmers. Eben was born in 1978 in Leeds, England. His dad was actually an English professor and he co-authored with his dad the Oxford Rhyming Dictionary while he was just growing up.
Oxford Rhyming Dictionary.
The Oxford Rhyming Dictionary. Actually, my dad used to write these little couplets, and he used the Oxford Rhyming Dictionary when he would write them.
Huh.
So I'm familiar with that book. Upton received a Bachelor of Arts in Physics.
There's the tie-in. Exactly. The physicist guys.
Exactly. Bachelor of Arts in Physics and Engineering in 1999 from the University of Cambridge. He completed the Cambridge Diploma in Computer Science in 2001, and he received his PhD from the University of Cambridge Computer Lab in 2006. Now, while he was working on his PhD, he served as Director of Undergraduate Studies in Computer Science at St. John's College, Cambridge, while completing his PhD. And one of his jobs was handling undergraduate computer science admissions. That's when he came up with the idea for a cheap hobbyist computer. You see, the applicants that he talked to were working on computers, but they weren't working with computers. So they knew how to play games. They knew how to post Facebook pictures, but they actually weren't programming the computers. So they had changed from active hackers, which was what he was while he was growing up, to passive consumers. So they actually had stopped doing any kind of development. And I mean, if you buy an Apple machine, you really can't do much programming on it. You just have the applications. And so he decided that he had to do something about that because this was a bad prognosis for the future of computer science. You see, in the 1980s, he and his friends learned to basic computer science skills working on a BBC Micro, which was a bare bones machine that was available in most English schools. He felt that the world needed a low cost equivalent, sort of a hobbyist machine that you could hack on. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at sort of the beginning of the computer hobby club that say Bill Gates was in and Wozniak was in, they were hacking on computers back in the 80s. So this was sort of the beginning of the computer generation when people thought they could learn how to use a computer and they felt real power with it. Now computers become more blasé. People have become more blasé about computers and use them, but they don't try to configure them so much. So he got the idea of making this hobbyist machine. So he went ahead and built a prototype because he was kind of a hardware guy. Of the next generation hobbyist machine, and he called it Raspberry Pi. Now, this name was suggested by one of his Cambridge professors, and it was based on the tradition, the long-standing tech tradition of naming computers after fruit. I mean, Steve Jobs
Apple?
Did.
Right?
Yeah, Steve Jobs did with Apple. Now, Bill Gates he didn't get the message. Bill Gates really wasn't a hacker.
Mm-hmm.
He was more of a businessman.
Right.
So he didn't get the message about the fruit naming. So he called it Raspberry Pi. But after he finished his PhD, but then what happened was, he said, okay, if I want to change the world, I'm going to have to make hundreds of thousands of these Raspberry Pis.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't figure out how to produce it, how to afford to produce it. He didn't have any money. So the project was put on hold because the prototype that he made would just be too expensive to produce. Now, when he finished his – so that was sort of put on hold. He put that in a memory bank. He said, okay, I'll get to that someday. So after he finished his PhD, Upton went to work at the Cambridge, UK office of Broadcom. Broadcom, of course, makes chips. They do a lot of application-specific integrated circuits, so-called ASICs. And so he went to work for Broadcom. That's a networking company based in Southern California. I mean, a lot of the Wi-Fi chips are Broadcom chips. They make all kinds of chips relating to networking. Now, he was technical director and ASIC architect. ASIC, of course, an application-specific integrated circuit, an ASIC architect. And in that position, Upton was very instrumental in the creation of Broadcom's first microprocessor intended for multimedia applications. Now, the number for this thing was BCM2835. It was released in 2011, and the BCM2835 was a single chip that could fit in a phone. And it was powerful enough to include a CPU, central processing unit, as well as a graphics processor. So clearly this chip was being made for a smartphone. Extremely powerful and very compact. Upton realized that this BCM2835 could be used to jumpstart the Raspberry Pi. That chip could be the heart of the Raspberry Pi, and it could bring it down to a reasonable price. So he and about a half dozen volunteers started working on a new version of the Raspberry Pi using this multimedia chip from Broadcom. Now, the problem is this BCM2835 wasn't really easy to deal with. It It required a lot of components, including 5 power supplies, which is, you know, so they actually had to do some redesign. And to keep the Raspberry Pi cheap, they wanted to build it on a single circuit board. I mean, there was one major chip on the circuit, but they wanted a single circuit board. And in order to build it on a single circuit board, they discovered that they'd have to have 8 stacked layers of circuitry on the board. And they said, that's going to be too expensive. So they worked and worked and worked to redesign it, and they got it down to 6 stacked layers of circuitry on the board, and that was doable. And they actually produced their first prototype in December of 2011. Now get this. The sales price was $25. He was trying to get a very low-cost machine. $25. Now, the Raspberry Pi includes 5 ports. An HDMI port. This is for high-definition video going out. That's to hook the computer up to a television, HDMI, so you can hook it up to a television. It includes a USB port to hook it up to multiple devices. It includes Ethernet for a data connection. It includes an analog TV output as well as an analog stereo output. It doesn't have a hard drive, so it boots from an SD card, which is a memory card, and it boots using a Fedora version of Linux. So it's on a circuit board that's the size of a credit card.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it on page 5 there.
And I'm looking at a picture of it online.
Oh, you're looking at a picture.
And I just sent you a link that has cases you can get for your Raspberry Pi.
That's right, cases. And so this thing doesn't come with a keyboard, doesn't come with a display. It's basically a hacking machine. And he's really quite proud of it. So if you connect it to a television and a keyboard, you can actually run it as a desktop PC, and it'll play high definition video. Now, almost the instant that Raspberry Pi went on sale, the orders crashed the website of the two vendors. So you can imagine this. They had an initial stock of 10,000. It sold out in minutes.
Whoa!
This was December of 2011.
Mm.
Now, Upton is now making more devices through the nonprofit organization Raspberry Pi Foundation. He wants to sell around 2 million devices a year in order to reach critical mass because he wants to have a big user group who can share ideas and projects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Raspberry Pi Model 2, or Model B, Raspberry Pi Model B comes with Ethernet as well as 512 megabytes of RAM. You'll still have to add the SD, 4 gigs of SD. You'll have to get a keyboard and a monitor. But that sells for $35.
Wow.
It's through a couple of vendors selling it. You can go to raspberrypi.org to find out all about it. RaspberryPi.org, raspberrypi.org, to find out about it. But I'll tell you, if you want to give a gift to somebody in high school or grade school who wants to play around, give them a Raspberry Pi. There's an instruction book for it. There are starter kits for it. And it's a great way to start somebody out programming and hacking a machine. It's really a great educational
tool. That's pretty wild.
Tool. And you can use it as a heart of a robot if you want.
How about that? Pretty crazy. Never know what you're going to learn here on Tech Talk.
You never know.
What we're going to talk about. This is Tech Talk Radio. Hope you're paying attention. We'll have a quiz in just a second that will maybe yield some free food for you. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, 5 of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
For those of you that are listening for the first time, this is actually a classroom of the airways,
right.
Not a radio show.
No.
Our longtime listeners know that.
Yes. Even the co-host knows that.
The co-host
now.
Knows that
took me
now.
A few years.
Yes.
Figured it out.
That's right. And so, of course, if there's a classroom with instruction going on, that means there must be some sort of assessment method, which would be called a pop quiz.
That's going to say the dumbed-down version would be pop quiz, right?
That's right. So that's how we do it. We have an assessment every show. If you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, in addition to getting an A-plus for this particular class
session.
Which
really means nothing.
Yeah, well, it's... No, it means something.
Do you get any classroom credit hours for it? No.
No, that's not.
No.
This is a non-credit class.
Okay.
But you will get two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karem Dining Room, which would be very good. And so if you just call in with the right answer, you will discover all of the great food that we offer at Stratford University. Earlier in the show, I was talking about the man who developed, in fact, created the Raspberry Pi hobbyist computer, Eben Christopher Upton. Eben Christopher Upton, at the heart of this particular Raspberry Pi, there's a chip, a processor chip that allowed it to be sold at the price point that he was aiming for, either $25 or $35. Who makes the chip that is at the heart of the Raspberry Pi?
Well, in order to get your A-plus and your free food, you have to get us the answer. And the only way really to do that in a timely fashion is to call us on your telephone. The number, if you're calling from west of Leeds, England, is 410. And wait a minute. It's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of the left side of my brain, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333.
Yes, indeed.
And if you were calling from Bangalore...
If you're calling from Bangalore or Afghanistan, you can call through Skype, and you simply go to Tech Talk Radio 1, and that call will be forwarded directly to the studio.
There you go.
Free of charge.
Okay.
Now, Philips, I was saying, has released some LED lights that are remotely controlled. How would you like to be able to control every single light bulb in your house individually?
That's pretty cool.
So instead of turning on 10 lights in the room, you actually individually control each one of the light bulbs. Now, You could actually control them as a group, so you could control them all at the same time. And then how would you like to be able to actually change the color of the lights at will? You could say, maybe this is a little blue. You could change the hue of the lights.
It'd be pretty neat.
You could change everything through a remote control device. Well, Philips has released what they're calling the Hue LED light bulbs. The Hue LED light bulbs. And these light bulbs are fully customizable. They offer a choice of what they say 16 million colors, because you can pick any color you want, using three LEDs, one green, one red, and one blue inside the bulb. Their market is being high efficiency, more efficient than regular light bulbs, with a brightness on par with a 50-watt light bulb and a maximum power draw of just 8.5 watts. What a deal that is. But the energy efficiency is just one plus of the Hue system. The main selling point is the extreme level of customization. Buyers will be able to fine-tune their lighting through an iOS app, an app that runs on the iPhone, or using their computer via the Philips website. An Android version of the app is coming out soon. So they can actually control the exact color of every single light that they want. Now, the starter pack is coming out now. For $199, it includes three LED light bulbs and a bridge that connects to the router. because you communicate to the light bulbs through Wi-Fi. So there's a bridge that actually is connected to your Wi-Fi network. You communicate to the light bulbs, goes to the bridge, then the bridge communicates with each one of the LEDs and controls the color. Now, once you're all set up, you'll be able to set the color of each bulb individually or choose from one of four templates that Philips has chosen. Additional Hue bulbs can be purchased for $59, and Philips says that one bridge can support 50 light bulbs. So, I mean, what they're coming out with in the future is you can actually tie this system to your stereo so you can actually have disco kind of lighting in your house.
Whoa, cool.
It gives you complete and absolute control. I think this is the way light bulbs are going to go because you don't have to change the light bulbs very often. Now, I mean, a $59 light bulb could be a small disadvantage
at the
moment. But I'm thinking if you've got a TV room and you want to have absolute control over the lights, having these things,
because
right now I've got the remote control on my iPhone for my TV. If I could now control the lights with my iPhone, I'd just be an iPhone heaven. So I'm thinking I may put these in my TV room. They're like eight light bulbs. It could be I don't know, $400.
Good grief.
Now, the light bulbs conform. They just went on sale October 30th. They're only sold in the Apple store now.
Of course they are.
Now, they adhere to the Zigbee Light Link Wireless Standard. The Zigbee Light Link Wireless Standard. That'd be Zigbee. Mm-hmm. Now, the Zigbee Alliance, I went and looked at this up. It was a global alliance designed to develop global wireless standards for a wide range of home devices. It's been in existence since 2002. And Philips is a charter member of Zigbee. It's kind of interesting. There are a lot of Zigbee devices on there that conform to the Zigbee standard, so you'll be able to ultimately control more than just light bulbs through the Zigbee standard.
People's thoughts or something
I don't know. If you want to get more detail on it, because I kind of like to know, about the technology behind the technology, you can go to Zigbee.org, Zigbee.org, to find out about the standards. And this is kind of a glimpse into where home controls are going. And there you go.
Well, we had a winner on the line, and he's dropped off. So let's go. Doc, we'll talk about – actually, we'll take a break.
Okay.
Put the number out once again. The pop quiz question. Ask it one more time.
Yes, the pop quiz question. We had – we were, of course, talking about the man who was behind Raspberry Pi, Eben Upton.
Mm-hmm.
What company makes the chip that is at the heart of the Raspberry Pi?
All right, it is 877-936-9333. 877-936-9333. That is the number to call. 877-936-9333. This is Tech Talk. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different. With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed. Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology.
And we have a little bit of unfinished business here. Let us get a win in the pop quiz.
Yes.
We will go to line one. This is Lewis calling us from Rockville, Maryland. Good morning, Lewis. How are you?
Pretty good, thank you.
Good. All right, Doc, ask the question, please.
Yeah, earlier in the show, we talked about the man who was behind Raspberry Pi. Of course, that would be Eben Upton. What company makes the chip that is at the heart of the Raspberry Pi? Broadcom, that is correct.
That is enthusiastically that given is to correct. Us. Lewis, you're the winner. Lewis. Thank you for listening.
Thank you
for calling.
Thank
and
you.
Hang on just a second here. And Professor Andrew Mitchell of the Research, Development, and Prize Department will be right with you.
Yes.
So let us continue on now, shall we?
Well, now what I want to do, I want to give a little bit more detail about the Raspberry Pi. I talked about the guy behind it. Of course, Raspberry Pi, I selected this as the device of the week. It's that credit card-like computer that plugs into a TV and keyboard. It's a miniature ARM-based PC that can be used for many things that that desktop PCs do, like spreadsheets, word processors, and games. It also plays high-definition video. It's priced at $35. There's some delivery delay because of the huge demand. They're saying it's like maybe a couple of months delay. Now, you can get accessories for this. A case is around $6, like a clear plastic case. 4 gigabyte SD flash memory, which you have to have, is around $7.50. Of course, the software, the Fedora-based Linux software, you can download for free. And you can get OpenOffice. All the applications will be free. They'll all be open source. It needs a power supply that you can get for around $8. It needs a USB hub. Because there's just one USB port, and if you want to hook up to multiple devices, you'll need a hub. USB hub's around $6. A keyboard is $23. That's the most expensive item, but chances are you may have a keyboard at home. You may already have a keyboard, and your display is going to be, of course, a TV. There are starter kits around $100, and that includes everything that you need to start hacking. Because if you want to use the Raspberry Pi to say to control a robot, you've got to connect it to servos, so then you got to have another circuit board with patch cords and everything. So it gives you all of the tools that you need to interface the Raspberry Pi computer to actually do things with it. Now, the website, and you can find out a lot of information, is, of course, raspberrypi.org. It lists the two vendors that are currently offering the device and its accessories. There's a Magpie magazine, Magpie, M-A-G-P-I magazine. It's written by the community, then it's produced by Raspberry Pi owners. It's now available in print as well as a free download, so you can get all kinds of ideas on things you can make with the Raspberry Pi. There's a great user community wrapped around this thing. There's also a forum where Raspberry Pi users share their ideas. The forum is currently being hosted at elinux.org. So you simply go to elinux.org/Raspberry Pi board, and there's a wiki there, and people are sharing all their ideas. You can download CDs with all sorts of applications on it, software on it. This is a great educational tool, and I'll tell you, I highly, highly recommend it. I think this is going to be picked up by a lot of schools that want to get kids interested in computer science early on. A great device of the week.
Excellent. Doc, let's take a quick break here,
okay,
and we'll come right back. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. We'll have more technology news right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University Talk Technology, and the Republicans are using more social media.
Ah.
In 2008, the Dems ruled the social media lines. This year, the parties have reached rough parity as Republicans have taken a renewed interest in social media. In fact, they have embraced social media. Millions of Republicans have taken social networks to wage debates about topics such as health care reform. Driven partly by the emergence of the Tea Party. The Tea Party seems to be very big into social networking. Mm-hmm. In 2008, the Democratic Party was so far ahead of the Republican Party in terms of their social savvy that they completely owned the conversation about the election on social media. In 2012, the Republican Party made some adjustments and investments in social media to try to level the playing field, though the Democratic Party still holds a slight edge as being first to market. By the time Election Day came along in November in 2008, Obama had nearly 2.5 million supporters on Facebook, five times more than John McCain. The Democratic candidate was present on Flickr. He had his own YouTube channel. McCain did not. On Twitter, Obama had 118,000 followers. McCain had 4,900. On the actual election day, McCain did not even post a single tweet, which in the Twitter-hungry world of today would be unheard of. Four years on, as today, Democrats still dominate the digital landscape, but they're no longer alone. Republican challenger Mitt Romney's present on all platforms and has a large number of followings. The Republicans took Obama's recipe to organize themselves using the internet to mobilize the ground. The site Freedom Works, a nonprofit organization involved with the Tea Party movement, has a Freedom Connector app that allows conservative activists to connect with like-minded people state by state, county by county, via Facebook. Driven in part by the Tea Party social media drive, the Republicans bridged a bit of the gap during the 2010 midterm elections, benefiting, for instance, from the arrival of retirees on the social network. That's a big deal. The retirees are there. Nevertheless, @BarackObama, which is his Twitter account, still has more Twitter followers than Romney. Obama has 21 million Twitter followers, and Romney has 1.65 million. Out of these, only 55% of Barack Obama's live in the U.S., whereas 85% of Mitt Romney's live in the U.S. Romney followers are deemed to be more involved than Obama's, though. Romney gets more retweets per tweet than does Obama. During the week of October, for instance, @MittRomney tweet was retweeted 1,300 times on average against only 900 times on average for Obama, according to the 140 statistics site. As for the candidate's running mates, whose popularity online is linked to domestic issues, as you would expect, Paul Ryan is almost twice as followed as President Joe Biden. So the Republicans have made some headway in that, and it makes for a much more interesting election.
Well, we got about a minute or so.
We've got about a minute to go. So Georgia actually outs a hacker by posting his webcam photo. There was a hacker. This is the state of Georgia. There was a hacker that was actually putting spyware on websites that government officials would visit, and then it would download a program, and then the program would open up a backdoor to the servers, and then he was getting all of the secret information from the Georgian government. Well, they tracked down what he did. They put on a particular piece of software that said, you know, like NATO secrets. He downloaded that. He opened that file. It installed something on his computer, and it opened up his webcam. So they took a picture of him hacking them, and they posted that to the web. And now the guy has been outed.
Wow.
Listen, this was a fun show. We're out of time. Go to stratford.edu and make certain to email us at techtalk@stratford.edu.
And if you like this show, you can hear it again this afternoon. It's actually tomorrow afternoon at 6 p.m. We'll see you next week.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio.
I'm going to put those CDs in my car, so I'll at least bring those. And if you find some good music.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.